Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Under the Radar by Annette Dashavy, narrated by Romy Nordlinger. 1. Did it seem odd to you? Zoe Chambers asked her paramedic partner, Earl Coulter, as the pair stepped out of the Walden's Cafe. The way Tony shoot us out? Earl adjusted his grip on the plastic bags holding his half of the ambulance crew's lunch order.
I figured he was hungry.
Zoe wasn't buying the simple explanation. There was something more. The cold breeze of early November blew a mist of rain into her face. Hands full with bags containing the rest of the takeout order, she tipped her head so the bill of her ball cap shielded her eyes. The leaden gray sky had been dumping rain on them all morning and most of the previous week. At first, she thought their crew chief, Tony DeLuca, had merely hustled them out on the lunch run due to the lull and the heavier precipitation. But she'd known him too long. He wasn't hungry. He was worried. Her concerns amped up when she and Earl rounded the corner at the top of the hill. Below them, a crowd gathered on the sidewalk in front of their ambulance garage. Earl saw it, too.
What's going on?
Zoe scanned the throng. Still too far away to make out expressions, she didn't sense upset or fear radiating from the small mob. She'd worked on Monongahela County's EMS long enough to recognize the emotions surrounding an accident or crime scene and saw none of that. Instead, they appeared curious, jostling for a better view into the large front window. Earl shifted his takeout bags to one hand, dug out his phone, and thumbed the screen. Who are you texting?
Tony, I want to know what we're walking into.
Zoe picked up her pace. We'll find out soon enough. The industrial-sized garage door in front of the first bay rumbled open as they approached, and a man Zoe had become all too familiar with led a small entourage out onto the sidewalk. Charles Davis, she muttered, more to herself than to Earl.
Oh, goody. How did we manage to become a campaign stop?
Dr. Charles Davis, forensic pathologist and candidate for the county coroner's position, popped open a black umbrella against the drizzle. He lifted his face and spotted them.
Aw!
His voice carried, rising over the spatter of rain on Zoe's ball cap and jacket.
Miss Chambers, I was hoping to run into you.
She sensed every eye in the crowd turn in her direction. Even Earl looked at her. Davis was determined to put the current coroner out of a job, which would subsequently eliminate her part-time gig as deputy coroner. She doubted the candidate was here to offer her a position on his staff, especially since most of the re-elect Franklin Marshall signs dotting Phillipsburg's and Vance Township's roadsides were her doing. Battling her desire to veer from her path and go anywhere but the garage, she braced for the confrontation and closed the distance between them. Earl kept with her, moving like one of the Steelers' offensive linemen. Zoe stopped in front of Davis. "You came here just to see me?" she asked, knowing it wasn't true.
"Of course not," he sniffed. "I've come to talk to the good people of Phillipsburg, including the brave first responders of the county EMS. I'll be working closely with everyone here in the near future. I thought I should get to know them."
She didn't miss his use of them rather than you. Maybe he thought he had the power to fire her from this job, too. Tony, who hadn't returned Earl's text, appeared through the crowd and took her takeout bags from her. Was he afraid she'd drop the guy's lunch? Or was he hungry and expected this conversation to take a while? She caught and read his pained expression.
"You knew he was coming," she said sotto voce. "His campaign manager called earlier and said he'd be here at noon."
Tony matched her low tone.
"I hoped he'd be in and out before you guys got back."
He and the crew's lunch headed for the safety of the EMS office. Davis kept his cold eyes and saccharine smile directed at Zoe.
"I did want to speak to you too, Ms. Chambers, in case you held out any delusions of continuing to work for my office once I'm elected. I thought it only fair to inform you your services will not be needed.
She hoped her poker face honed through many Saturday night card games with her local friends and colleagues held firm. Are you using a magic eight ball to predict the future these days? His smile wavered closer to a snarl, but he recovered.
I don't need a magic eight ball, Miss Chambers. I have pulls that place me solidly in the lead, as it should be.
He aimed his voice over his shoulder to the voting public behind him.
Monongahela County's residents are tired of living in the Dark Ages, where truth and justice are laid in the hands of butchers and funeral directors. Men,
he raised an eyebrow,
and women who aren't qualified to dissect a frog, but are given the responsibility of determining how crime and accident victims died. How many killers have gone free because these inept amateurs declared a death to be from natural causes when, in fact, murder was involved? How many incompetent medical doctors have avoided legal actions because nothing deemed suspicious was detected during autopsy?
Davis used the hand not gripping the umbrella to make air quotes around autopsy. The phone inside the garage rang, but Davis didn't bat an eye. Had they not been surrounded by a couple dozen townspeople, plus a handful of local reporters, Zoe wouldn't have graced the man with a reply. He was well aware of how the coroner's office worked. The public, however, appeared to be buying his lies. As I'm sure you're aware, Coroner Franklin Marshall contracts with a licensed forensic pathologist to perform all autopsies. And I think even you have to agree that Dr. Abercrombie is more than qualified. Davis beamed triumphantly.
Thank you for bringing that up. Yes, in its current sad state, the coroner's office must pay to have qualified personnel perform autopsies. That's taxpayers' money going toward an unnecessary expense, one that will be eliminated once I'm elected.
Zoe cringed. She'd taken the bait and set Davis up for one of his key campaign promises.
Zoe, Tony shouted from the office doorway. Earl?
The crew chief flapped a slip of paper.
You're up.
He faced the crowd.
Please clear the front of the station so we don't run over anyone.
She and Earl were not the team who was supposed to take the next run. Tony was rearranging the order to get her away from Davis and his followers. She owed her crew chief a big favor, although the swap meant she would miss lunch. Earl led the way, herding the crowd back as he strode toward Medic 2. Zoe followed in his wake without another glance at the coroner candidate or at the faces of his audience. Earl shoved his takeout bags at Tony and headed for the driver's door. The crew chief handed the paper to Zoe and caught her arm as she passed, pulling her close enough to whisper in her ear.
The caller was Horace Pavelka. He claims he shot and killed a man. Police are en route.
Zoe met Tony's gaze. He'd refrained from mentioning a shooting in front of the media and Davis to save her and Earl from being followed to the scene. But it was the caller's name that explained why Tony told Zoe instead of Earl. She gave her crew chief a quick nod of appreciation, climbed into the passenger seat, and told Earl, Langstown. Earl whooped the siren as a woman with a camera stepped in front of the ambulance to snap a photo. She scuttled backward, tripped, but regained her balance. As the woman lowered her camera, Zoe caught a glimpse of her face. Is that? The woman turned away before Zoe could be sure. Earl wheeled Medic 2 left onto Main Street and hit the gas.
You gonna tell me what this call is, or are you saving it for a surprise?
Zoe erased the mental image of a woman she hadn't seen in almost a year, and probably hadn't seen a moment ago either. Horace Pavelka claims he shot and killed someone.
Horace who?
Zoe repeated the last name. We were friends in high school.
Never heard of him.
I'm not surprised. He was very quiet, reserved, shy. Still is. Earl glanced her way.
Still? You've seen him recently?
He works at Brunswick Bakery. I've stopped in a couple of times about She let the thought trail off. The stress of rushing into an emergency situation involving a shooting couldn't compete with the stress of planning the happiest day of her life.
"About your wedding cake?" Earl asked with a grin.
"Yeah." She picked up the mic. "Control, this is Medic 2. Show us en route." Earl grew quiet, and the wail of the siren filled the silence. As they approached the turn from Phillipsburg's main street onto the road to take them up Langstown Hill, Earl asked,
"Your shy wedding cake baker friend shot someone?"
"So he says." In theory, Vance Township Police Chief Pete Adams had Saturdays off. In reality, neither the calendar nor the weather kept him from responding to a homicide call in his jurisdiction. Langstown was one of the many former coal mining towns dotting Vance Township and southwestern Pennsylvania. It had fared better than most. When the coal petered out and the mines shut down, a steel production company took over and operated until a few decades ago. While the old mill still limped along, employing a skeleton crew, the once thriving town's nicer homes suffered the same neglect as the cookie-cutter company houses. Pete tugged on his ball cap, stepped out into the cold November drizzle, and took in the scene. A tarp covered a human-shaped mound at the end of a narrow driveway, a baseball bat a few feet away. Pete's weekend officer, Nate Williamson, held a shotgun, not his department issue, and loomed over an older model red Chevy Malibu coupe, its headlights and passenger side window shattered. The windshield showed evidence of blunt force trauma, although it remained intact. A man with thinning red hair perched on the edge of the driver's seat, hugging his left elbow close to his body. Sirens keened in the distance. Pete approached his officer.
"What have we got?" Nate tipped his head at the man in the car. "This is Horace Pavelka. He lives here."
Nate glanced over the car's hood at the body.
"The deceased is Dennis Culp. Shotgun blast to the center of the chest."
Nate hefted the 12-gauge shotgun, an inexpensive tactical pump with an 18.5-inch barrel, the kind used for protection, not hunting.
"Horace admits to discharging the weapon and willingly surrendered it to me."
The man in the car raised his round, tear-streaked face.
"I was afraid he was going to kill me."
Pete knew Culp. Tough guy, or so he fancied himself. Opinionated and convinced that his take on any topic was the only one that mattered. But any time Pete had gone toe-to-toe with a man, Culp had backed down. A cluster of onlookers huddled on the sidewalk several houses away, some with their phones out taking photos. Neighbors gathered on the porches of the surrounding homes. Pete noticed a woman watching them from the house next door, an address he used to be well acquainted with. He met her emotionless gaze, expecting she'd turn away or lower her face. She did neither. A pair of Pennsylvania State Police SUVs made the turn onto the street and cut their sirens, although more filled the air. Pete looked at Nate.
"Did you call for EMS?"
"Yep."
He tipped his head toward Pavelka.
"He needs his arm looked at."
Meeting Pete's gaze, Nate's lips curled with a hint of grin.
"Recoil."
The grin vanished.
"And I called the coroner. Tag and secure the weapon, then rope off the area and handle crowd control."
Pete gestured toward the amateur paparazzo.
"I want any pictures or videos they've shot, and question the neighbors, anyone who saw what happened."
He looked at the neighbor woman still standing on her porch, watching.
"Except her. I'll talk to Mrs. Gates. On it, Chief."
As Nate strode away, Pete turned to the man in the car.
"Mind if I ask you some questions?"
Pavelka glanced after Nate.
"I already told him what happened."
"I know you did."
Pete gave him a sympathetic smile.
"Unfortunately, you'll have to repeat your story a few more times before we wrap this up."
Pavelka cradled his left arm and rocked like a mother soothing her child.
"Okay."
Pete opened his notebook.
"Tell me what happened."
I was coming home from work.
Where's that?
Brunswick Bakery.
I saw Dennis and his buddies standing on the sidewalk in front of my house, waiting on me.
How did you know they were waiting on you and not just hanging out? Because it's not the first time.
A marked Monongahela County police cruiser rounded the turn at the end of the block and rolled toward them.
Not the first time? Pete echoed. They've been harassing me for months.
Who are they?
Dennis, Grant, and Stanley Jennings. And Reese Perkins.
Pete jotted down the names. Along with Culp, he'd encountered the Jennings brothers all too often. Drunk and disorderlies by the dozens. A handful of simple assaults. But Reese Perkins? Never heard of him.
All four of them were standing there when I drove up, blocking my driveway so I couldn't get in. Dennis had the bat, was swinging it around and leering, calling me names, yelling I should get out of my car.
Did you?
Pavelka's eyes widened.
No, I was scared, terrified, for my life, you know?
A black, unmarked sedan with red and blue lights embedded in the grill turned onto the street. An ambulance followed.
What did you do? Pete asked.
I tried to drive through them, tried to get into my driveway. I hoped they'd get out of my way, but Dennis wouldn't move. He started bashing on my car, the hood, the headlights, the windshield.
Pete surveyed the interior of the car. Glass pebbles glittered on the passenger seat.
And the window?
Yeah.
Then what?
Horace stared at his knees.
I shot him. Through the broken window.
What did the others do?
They ran.
Smart move. You carry a shotgun in your car?
The soft splat of footsteps approaching on the rain-soaked road drew Pete's attention. Zoe and Earl had parked their rig in the middle of the street and lugged a pair of medical bags and portable defibrillator with them. County Detective Wayne Baronic trailed behind. Pete met Zoe's gorgeous baby blues and answered her unspoken question by nodding toward the tarp-covered mound. To Earl, he said,
"This gentleman seems to have injured his arm."
Instead of diverting to the deceased's body as Pete expected, Zoe paused, looking at Pavelka.
"Horace?" she said.
"Zoe?"
he replied, his voice quivering, pleading. She looked to Pete, to the body, and back to the man in the car.
"I'll talk to you in a bit," she said. "Okay?"
"Okay."
She crossed in front of the car to deal with the body. Pete didn't have to watch. He knew she'd begin in paramedic mode, even though the man was clearly beyond help. Once she confirmed the fact, she'd note the official time of death and slip into deputy coroner mode, photographing and processing the body. Earl set his jump kit on the hood of the car and removed a blood pressure cuff and stethoscope. Baronic, attired in a long dark raincoat and fedora, acknowledged Pete with a nod and followed Zoe. While Earl took Pavelka's vitals, Pete resumed his questions.
"The shotgun. Why did you have it in your car?"
The man's voice was little more than a whisper.
"Protection from those men, Dennis and his gang."
"You mentioned they'd been harassing you. How?"
He looked up at Pete, his eyes brimming.
"Following me around stores in town, crowding me, pushing me. Dennis tripped me outside the bargain store in Phillipsburg 2 weeks ago."
Pavelka held open his palms, revealing healing abrasions.
"I was scraped up real good. They laughed, said I was a clumsy oaf, called me all sorts of names."
He winced as Earl palpated the elbow he'd been shielding.
"I had a dog. I found her."
His voice broke.
"Dead. Poisoned. I know it was them. I can't prove it, but I know it was them. Last week they threw a rock through my kitchen window. Again, I can't prove anything, but I know."
Pete gazed at the surrounding houses. Horace Pavelka's home was plain but neat. Jen Gates no longer watched him. Dead hanging baskets decorated her now vacant front porch. Pete scanned the small crowd behind the yellow tape Nate had strung. She wasn't with them. The state troopers and county officers worked the locals, asking questions. Someone on this street had seen what transpired. If no one else, Jan Gates most assuredly had.
"Chief," Earl said, "do you mind if I take him over to the ambulance to immobilize his arm?"
Pete held up a finger. "One minute."
"Mr. Pavelka, I have to ask, if these men have been intimidating you for months, as you say, why haven't you reported them to me?"
He slouched forward.
"It was their word against mine."
Pete opened his mouth to tell him he should have gotten the threats on record. Pavelka cut him off.
"And because they said they'd kill me if I said anything."
2. One look at the body beneath the tarp told Zoe that Dennis Culp was dead. The shotgun blast at close range, center mass, left a hole the size of her fist in his chest. His lifeless eyes stared at the sky, a look of surprise frozen on his face. She wiggled her hands into a pair of nitrile gloves, clipped a blood ox meter to his finger, and checked his pupils for the non-existent reaction. She spread open his unzipped jacket, slipped her scissors from her pocket, and cut the front of his sweatshirt, allowing her to attach the EKG leads. The flatline on the monitor officially confirmed what she already knew. She looked at her watch and noted TOD, 12:57. What the hell had happened? Sweet, soft-spoken Horace Pavelka had taken a life?
"Can I give you a hand?"
She shook her head, clearing it of personal assumptions, and looked up at Wayne Baronic, who waited patiently for her to shift from lifesaver to death investigator. "In a minute. I need to get some photos first."
"All right. I'll check on our witnesses and be right back."
By the time she'd put away the defibrillator and taken photos of the body as she'd found it, wider angle shots showing the man's position on the sidewalk and closer shots to catch all the details, Wayne returned.
"What do you need me to do?" he asked.
"Help me roll him."
"You do know it was a shotgun, right? There isn't going to be an exit wound."
She gave him her best dull look. "I still have to roll him and photograph what is or isn't under the body."
Wayne winked at her. "Oh,
you're not funny."
"Pete tells me the same thing."
Nate Williamson wandered over as Zoe held the victim's head and Wayne knelt next to the body, reached across, and log-rolled the man toward him. Wayne had been right. No exit wound. Nothing under the body, either. "Hey," Zoe said to Nate, "grab my camera and take some pictures for me." Unlike the county detective with his warped sense of humor, Nate remained stoic as he accomplished the requested task. Once they'd returned the victim to his back and Zoe gingerly settled his head on the pavement, she stood and retrieved the notebook she'd been using to record her findings. "What can you guys tell me about the weapon used?"
"H&R tactical shotgun," Nate said. 12-gauge.
"Ammo?"
"Buckshot."
Zoe added the information to her notes. She'd been working with the coroner's office long enough to know about Franklin Marshall's zest for detailed reports. Wayne turned to Nate.
"My county guys have been talking with some of the neighbors. No one saw what happened, only the aftermath. What about you?"
"The neighbor over there." Nate lifted his chin toward the house to the left of Horace's place. "Said he heard raised voices and got up to look, but heard the gunshot before he made it to the window."
"What about the neighbor on the other side?"
"Chief said to leave her to him. Got the impression he knows her." Pete's voice confirmed Nate's suspicion.
"I do."
Zoe spun to find Pete standing behind her. "Is that a good thing or a bad thing?" she asked.
You knowing the neighbor lady, I mean. He shrugged.
Depends on what she tells me.
He fixed his icy gaze on Nate.
Have you knocked on all the other neighbors' doors already?
He slumped.
Not yet, sir.
Zoe concealed a grin. Nate Williamson towered over all of them and may or may not have been a professional football player, depending on whether you believed the rumors. But Pete had the commanding presence to wilt even the big guy.
He was helping me process the body, she said.
Nate shot a grateful glance her way.
Fine.
Pete jabbed a thumb toward the other side of the street.
Get back to work.
He eyed Wayne.
You too. May I remind you, you aren't my commanding officer?
Pete kept him locked in that cold, hard stare. Wayne growled in annoyance.
But I guess I should check on my men.
Through the gloves, Zoe fingered the diamond ring on her left hand. If they hadn't been standing over a dead body, she'd have nudged Pete's shoulder with her own, an innocent, crowd-safe gesture of affection they'd developed.
Do you know this guy? He asked.
She looked down at the man at her feet, and then over at the ambulance's open rear doors, where Earl was placing a sling on Horace's arm.
Which guy are you talking about?
I already gathered, you know, the shooter. What about the victim?
She brought her gaze back to the body in front of her.
I haven't seen him in years, but I know who he is.
Dennis Culp was a bully, but she wasn't going to offer her opinion as part of a homicide investigation.
How well do you know the shooter?
She pictured Horace's frightened face, his eyes wide and beseeching. His red hair tinged with gray had thinned, and lines creased his still babyish face. But the expression hadn't changed much in 2 decades. We graduated high school together.
That's all?
We were friends then. He's a baker now at Brunswick Bakery. A good one, too. She paused before continuing. I've stopped in a couple of times to talk to him recently. She paused again. About doing our wedding cake.
Oh.
Pete sounded surprised. His opened mouth hinted at a rare moment of speechlessness. The arrival of the county coroner's van rescued him from further comment, and saved her from having to reveal more of what she knew of Horace's past. She'd get Pete alone and share later. Franklin climbed from the passenger side and strode toward them. He greeted Pete with a nod before squatting next to the body.
Update, he said to Zoe.
Shotgun blast to the chest from close range. She handed him the notes she'd jotted. I've taken photographs and done a preliminary exam. No other obvious injuries. Franklin looked up at Pete.
Did anyone disturb the body prior to Zoe's arrival?
Nope. Nate didn't move him.
He gestured to a group of neighbors and their cell phones.
Just covered him to protect him from the looky-loos.
Good.
Franklin turned to Zoe.
Let's prep him for transport.
Pete knew from the look in her eyes that Zoe had more information about the shooter. He'd get it out of her later. For now, he left her and Marshall with Dennis Culp's body, climbed the next-door neighbor's porch steps. Jan Gates's late husband Everett had been a well-known and much-despised alcoholic who'd raise hell at several of the seedier local bars before going home and beating the crap out of his wife. On average, Pete and his officers would respond to a couple of domestic dispute calls a week at this address. Sometimes she'd let them haul Everett off to jail. Sometimes she'd tell them to leave her alone to handle the drunken bastard. Pete never understood why she refused to leave him or even file a PFA. At the time, she'd claimed she didn't have any kids to protect and insisted she could take care of herself, in spite of a black eye and bloody lip. The frequent calls to this address in Langstown ended a couple years ago when Everett drank himself into a stupor at Rodeo's bar, then failed to negotiate one of the bends on Langstown Hill, crashing through the guardrails and rolling his pickup down a steep embankment. He might have been saved had the wreck not gone unnoticed until mid-morning the next day.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?